It's one. I have two points on my, let's say, on my three sphere. One thing I can define is the co-moving distance between these two points. So, for example, that's the distance between the two points in these three in these with respect to these co-moving coordinates. So, you know, if this has coordinate chi 1 and this has coordinate chi 2, for example, the co-moving distance is chi 2 minus chi 1. And that just that the co-moving distance, so if you have two co-moving observers, one who sits at this point and one who sits at this point, even though the space expands, their co-moving distance, by definition, does not change with time. It's a constant with time. Okay? It's just that this one just always stays fixed at position chi 2. This one stays fixed at co-moving coordinate chi 1. Their co-moving distance is just this period. It doesn't change with time. But their physical distance does change. This one sits here on the balloon. This one sits here on the balloon. But then, you know, someone is blowing up the balloon. The balloon is getting bigger and bigger. And so their physical distance is, at a given time, is the scale factor, A of t, times their co-moving distance. So as the universe expands, the physical distance between two co-moving observers grows in proportion with the scale factor. Their co-moving distance stays fixed. Okay? Let's see. What else do we want to say? Oh, well, okay. And so then the next thing is that two things we discussed last time were, well, so one thing that we derived last time was, now if you have a non-co-moving observer, if you have an observer who does have a massive or massless particle that does have some spatial velocity initially, then as the universe expands, it's the magnitude of its spatial momentum. It just continues to move in the same direction, and the only thing that changes as a function of time is that the magnitude of its spatial momentum decreases as 1 over a, in proportion to 1 over a as the universe expands. Okay, yeah. You mean, oh, so you mean why did I only include these two coordinates? Yeah, so what I mean to say here is that, so I was imagining the situation in which these two points are both located on the same radial ray pointing outward from the origin here, in which case the distance is just this. But more generally, what I mean is that if you freeze time in this metric, if you in fact forget about time, just consider the three, just we're talking about the co-moving distance. So just consider the unit three sphere, or the unit what, or the co-moving space, the unit three sphere for concreteness. Then there is some distance between any two points. So in general, what I mean is you have to integrate the square root of this part of the metric, the part in square brackets, the co-moving part. You have to integrate the square root of that, the little spatial ds, co-moving ds, between one point and the other. How what? If we consider two observers, two points on the, so as we head out from the North Pole and we head down a line of longitude, so along that line of longitude, d theta and d phi aren't changing. The only thing that's changing along that line of longitude is chi. So the square root of d chi squared is just d chi. So I'm just integrating d chi from the first point to the second point. So I get chi 2 minus chi 1. Last time we showed that the magnitude of the spatial momentum, in other words, this thing, Gij contracted with Pi Pj, square root of, goes down as 1 upon a. So this is, in other words, intuitively, you can think of a picture people sometimes have is of, you know, dough with raisins in it. You're making raisin bread, and these raisins go on for infinity, infinite grid of raisins, and then you heat up, you cook the dough, and the bread expands, and the raisins just kind of expand along with the dough. So in this case, the raisins at rest with the expanding dough are the co-moving observers. And when the dough expands by a factor of A2 over A1, the linear distance between any two raisins increases by a factor of A2 over A1. And if you take a so-called co-moving box, in other words, a box with a fixed number of raisins in it, a box that expands along with the dough also, and so no raisins pass through the walls, the volume of that box goes up as in proportion to A cubed in three spatial dimensions. Okay, and so now let's imagine that for some reason you are rocketing through this dough, and you pass at time t1, you pass by raisin number one, and raisin number one measures your momentum and is like, oh my goodness, 100 kilograms meters per second, which is huge by raisin standards, you know, for momentum. And he immediately sends a telegram to the next raisin saying, you gotta see this, this guy's coming towards you, he's a huge momentum, 100 kilograms meters per second. And so this guy gets excited and he's, you know, eagerly awaits my arrival. But in the meantime, the bread is expanded by a factor of two. And by the time I get over here, you know, he's smiling, ready to greet me, and then he measures my momentum and he's like, what? Only 50 kilometers per second times kilograms, you know? Meters per second, you know. You understand what I mean. I believe the spirit of the story was clear, even if the details were all wrong. So in the non-relativistic limit, where my momentum, you know, this thing where my spatial momentum goes down is 1 upon a, that's exact, even if I'm moving relativistically. Once my velocity gets low enough that I'm non-relativistic, that this is just saying my velocity is going down is 1 upon a. And as I'm moving along, I'm not a co-moving observer. I'm shooting through the raisin bread here. My velocity, as measured by whatever my non-zero spatial velocity, as measured by whatever raisin I happen to be passing at that time, is my so-called peculiar velocity. And so, in the non-relativistic limit, so co-moving observers have zero peculiar velocity, but a non-relativistic massive particle, its peculiar velocity damps as 1 upon a. And that effect where the expansion of space-time somehow sucks velocity out of the particle is sometimes referred to as Hubble friction or Hubble drag. But I mean, it's really nothing more than the fact that if the bread is expanding here, then by the time I pass this raisin at 50 kilometers per second, well, this raisin is not at rest with respect to this raisin. The bread is expanding, so this raisin sees this raisin moving away from it. So by the time I catch up with it, you know, if it's moving away at 5 kilometers per second, I'm going to pass it at only 45 kilometers per second. You know, somehow this is the intuitive effect. For photons, what p going as 1 upon a means, that's really, if this is a photon going by, you know, the local raisin will always see it shoot by it. The speed of light, its velocity will always be the speed of light, but its momentum going as 1 upon a amounts to saying that its frequency is going down as 1 upon a. And that's just, intuitively, that's just saying that you can think of somehow, if the photon was at rest, as the universe expands, you know, that somehow the wave, it's expanding the wavelength of the photon along with it. It's as if these two points were pinned on the space-time, and as it expanded, the wavelength of the photon got stretched. So that's what's happening, but just at the same time, this thing is moving in the whatever direction at the speed of light. So that's what non-co-moving observers do. let's see. And the final thing I wanted to say about kinematics was just to revisit what we talked about last time about horizons for one more minute. So again, let's consider the case where the universe is spatially flat, capital K is equal to zero, and just take it for granted for a moment that the scale factor has the following functional form as a function of time. Okay, so it just expands proportional to t to the power p, where p is greater than zero and t runs from zero to infinity. Okay, so now if we convert to co-moving time here, so co-moving the co-moving time coordinate, maybe I'll just say, I forgot to review this, but so remember the one final thing to say about these coordinates is that we introduced the notion of co-moving time. We took any of these dt's and split it into a scale factor times d eta. And so any of these metrics that previously had the form minus dt squared plus a squared times something now looks like a squared times minus d eta squared plus the same something. Okay? And so from that relation, if we work out what the conformal time is, okay, it's dt over a, and now let's integrate this from, okay, so so at time t naught, we'll just take the conformal time to be some value of our choosing, eta naught, and then let's integrate up to some final time, tf, and see what the corresponding conformal time, eta f, is. Well, what you see is, you know, this is proportional to dt over t to the p. So if p is greater than 1, then as I take tf far into the past, as I take tf to 0, where the universe began expanding, started from 0 size, this integral dt over t to the p will diverge. Whereas if I take tf to infinity, if I take it to the end of the expansion, this integral converges when p is greater than 1. So in other words, I'll find that eta runs from minus infinity in the far past, that's the divergence in the far past, to some finite value, some finite maximal eta max. And if p is less than 1, the opposite thing happens. I'll find that as I take tf to 0, that the integral converges, and as I take tf to infinity, that it diverges. So now eta runs from some eta min to infinity. And so this is saying that in a universe with p greater than 1, or really a universe which is accelerating in the sense that a double dot is greater than 0. Let me not jump steps here. But at least for this special form of the metric, p greater than 1 or less than 1 corresponds to the distinction between whether a double dot, the acceleration of the universe, the quote unquote acceleration of the universe, is positive or negative. And the fact that eta hits a positive asymptotes to a finite value in the future says that this type of space-time has a future horizon. Whereas this guy, the fact that it asymptotes to a finite value in the past, it has a past horizon. And in other words, what this means is, so here we're just imagining that at some moment eta star, I'm drawing my sphere again when it's not appropriate. So at some moment eta star, this person here, if they send out a photon, then if they send that, they're at the origin of coordinates, let's say, for simplicity. Any point is the origin in the space-time. Any point is as good as any other. So let's take this person to be at the origin for convenience, and then when he sends out a photon, it just travels radially outward. So we'll use coordinates chi and eta. So in those coordinates, a photon has ds squared is equal to minus d eta squared plus d chi squared is equal to 0. A photon travels along a path that everywhere has ds squared equal to 0 along every infinitesimal element. So if he emits a photon, chi as a function of time is given by d chi is equal to d eta, or if we integrate this thing, chi as a function of eta is just eta minus eta at the moment when the photon was emitted. And so if eta reaches a finite value in the future, asymptotes to a finite value in the future, that means the photon will only ever make it to a finite value of the co-moving radial coordinate. It'll only ever reach a finite co-moving distance away. There's some portion of the space-time that it will never make it to. Okay, so that's called a future horizon. And again, it's analogous to being inside the black hole. Inside a black hole, again, you have some portion of the space-time to which if you try to send a photon, it'll just never make it there. And then alternatively, to illustrate this guy, if this guy receives a photon at time eta equals eta star, well, and he's at the origin of coordinates, then that photon's trajectory satisfied the differential equation d chi is equal to minus d eta, or in other words, chi as a function of eta is equal to eta star minus eta. So now, if I ask how far away did that photon come from in the far past? Well, in a space-time like this, with a past horizon, so in other words, in a decelerating space-time, even if I follow eta all the way back to the Big Bang, when a was equal to 0, when the scale factor was equal to 0, eta only reaches a finite value. And so you find that the photon only came from a finite co-moving radius, chi. So in other words, if you ask about regions of the space-time that are beyond that, if I ask for regions of the space-time that are beyond the maximum radius eta star minus eta min, someone beyond that radius can't have sent me a signal by this time. It just wouldn't have had time. A signal sent from a more distant point in the space-time, or on the spatial manifold, just wouldn't have had time to reach me since the Big Bang. Okay, and so that's called a past horizon, and again, that's analogous to being outside the black hole, where there are regions of the space-time that try as they may, simply cannot send you a light signal. Okay, and the one final point to make about this before moving on to the dynamics of FRW metrics is that this is now enough background material to qualitatively state one of the puzzles about the universe today, which was one of the original motivations for the tacking the notion of the so-called theory of inflation onto the early universe, and that is the horizon problem. So So the horizon problem is the following. If you take a telescope that observes at microwave frequencies and you look at the night sky in any direction, you find that the sky is full of microwave photons with a perfectly black body spectrum. That's not what a black body spectrum looks like. But they have a black body spectrum that looks as if they were emitted from some matter in perfect thermal equilibrium at some temperature T. We know very well exactly where those photons did come from. So in the early universe, all of the atoms in the universe, in the early universe, it was very hot. All of the atoms in the universe were ionized. And then at some rather well-defined moment in cosmic history, which in a sense that we'll describe later, was roughly speaking a few hundred thousand years after the Big Bang, it got cold enough that suddenly all of the ionized hydrogen atoms in the universe wanted to bind up with their corresponding electrons. So the hydrogen ions and their corresponding electrons bound into neutral atoms. And so photons, the universe was full of photons. Photons love to bang into and equilibrate with free charged electrons. They love to bump into charged things, but they don't like to bump into neutral atoms nearly as much. So suddenly the universe, instead of being a goo of plasma of charged particles, was essentially a gas of neutral particles, and all those photons, roughly speaking, had nothing else to bump into anymore, and they just went streaming across the universe, maintaining the thermal spectrum that they had at that moment. Okay, so that's they were released from at some very early moment in cosmic history, only a few hundred thousand years after the Big Bang. And the question is just, why do they all have the same temperature in different directions on the sky? Why is it that if I point my telescope this way and then point it 180 degrees away, that I get exactly the same spectrum of photons, indicating that when they were emitted by a plasma of exactly the same temperature? So you might say, well, if the idea is that the universe was incredibly small and dense in the far past, it was just a lot smaller, then maybe all of those different points, the plasma that emitted the CMB photons to me from this direction, and the plasma that emitted from over here, well, those may look very distant today, but the universe was contracting to the past, and so they were much closer in the past. Maybe they just had time to equilibrate with one another. Maybe that accounts for why they had the same temperature when they emitted their photons to me. Could I just finish this one thought and then I'll ask your question. So that explanation does not work in a universe that is always decelerating. So it used to be the case that people thought that the early universe was a purely decelerating universe, and we'll see why that is in a minute. But if the early universe was always decelerating, in other words, expanding, but with a double dot less than zero, then it can't. Then this question about why the CMB has the same temperature in every direction cannot have the resolution that I just said, because in sort of space-time terms, if I draw a diagram with the spatial direction chi, the comoving coordinate chi in this direction, and the comoving coordinate eta in this direction, then as I go to the past, eta only reaches some finite value in the far past. Okay, this is the surface on which the Big Bang happened, and it turns out that the moment at which the CMB was produced is some moment very early on, quite close to the surface. So if I look out with my telescope in this direction, I'm looking back along my light cone this way. So those CMB photons were produced over here, and the CMB photons from the other side of the sky were produced over here. so this is some moment 300,000 years after the Big Bang, but their past light cones only extend out to this size. They're completely non-intersecting. So in other words, these two points, in a picture in which the universe was undergoing decelerated expansion the whole time, the fact that these two points both are surrounded by past horizons that are completely non-intersecting means that they have just never had time to communicate with one another since the Big Bang. You know, by the time that this point in space was emitting thermal radiation to me, and this point in space were emitting thermal radiation to me with exactly the same temperature, they had never had a chance to talk to one another, had never had a chance to come into equilibrium with one another. And so why is it that they have the same temperature as if they were in thermal equilibrium with one another? Okay, so one proposed explanation of that is inflation, which is that you break the assumption that the universe was always decelerating in the early universe. You add whatever matter is necessary. You add some extra matter to ensure that A double dot is greater than zero at sufficiently early time. So in other words, up to this point, physics is the same. And as we go back a little bit, physics is the same. This corresponds, you know, somewhere back to here, corresponds to cosmology at sufficiently low temperatures that we understand very well and have various tests that we understand what's really going on. But then somewhere back here, at sufficiently early times, the universe started accelerating. And so this is no longer the surface of the Big Bang. The acceleration phase can push the surface of the Big Bang down to 80 equals minus infinity, like it does when p is greater than 1. And so these guys, you know, have plenty of time in the past to be in causal contact with one another. So anyway, that's one solution. Another solution would be to somehow come up with a physical theory that gave birth to the universe in a way that was perfectly homogeneous at the Big Bang. I mean, that's another. There are theories of so-called cosmological initial conditions or theories of the wave function of the universe, which you could hope would give an alternative explanation like that. There's no really comparably successful theory like that at the moment, but that's another thing you could hope to do. Or another thing you could try is to say, well, okay, maybe the universe was decelerating all the way back. So this really was the surface of the Big Bang here. But, you know, Big Bang, Schmig Bang, you know, it looks like it's a singularity in the metric, but that's because Einstein's theory is just a classical theory or something like this. Maybe at the quantum level, this was not really the beginning of the space-time, that there was a prior epoch on the space-time, prior epoch that extends back further, even though the scale factor really did go through zero at this point. Time did not really begin here, and so again, you add extra time in the past, in which to have these points, allow these points to make causal contact with one another. Okay, so that's so. So now you had a question a few minutes ago.
Oh,
that's true. So that's observed actually. So that in fact there is. Let's talk about that more when I get to the CMB. So to a very good approximation, the temperature is the same in all directions. It's true that if we have some velocity that even if the universe was homogeneous, so the CMB had the same temperature in all directions, but then we were not a co-moving observer, we had some peculiar velocity in some direction, then because of Doppler shifting, we would see the CMB to be a little bit hotter over here and a little bit less hot over here. And in fact, we do see that. And that fact is thought to be exactly accounted for by the fact that our galaxy does have a peculiar velocity. Well, the velocity of everything right now, roughly speaking, so our velocity through our galaxy, first of all, around the center of our galaxy, is like hundreds of kilometers per second, which is quite fast, but you know, by driving standards, but quite slow with respect to the speed of light. And then, okay, to a first approximation, that's the velocity of everything. All of the structures, all of the clusters and galaxies flying around in the universe today all have typical peculiar velocities of hundreds of kilometers per second, a couple hundred kilometers per second. Okay, let's see. So now I want to move, now I just want to say something about the dynamics of FRW, and then next time, so tomorrow I'm away again, so the next lecture is on Thursday, first of all, so there's two lectures by Ruth tomorrow, and then two by me on Friday, and so the next lecture, hopefully I'll finish the dynamic, I just want to say some relatively brief stuff about dynamics. And then in the next lecture, we'll start to talk about, or we'll talk about how to think about thermodynamics, statistical mechanics, and particle physics in expanding spacetimes. And then on Friday, we can finally get to understanding a lightning understanding of what the CMB, the physics of the CMB, the physics of so-called Big Bang nucleosynthesis, when the various light elements were synthesized after the Big Bang, and then begin to get to know dark matter, although probably also the beginning of next week will be about getting to know dark matter. But so dynamics. Maybe first, so Vorbichka again, so his mother says, you know, Vorbichka, where's your report card? And he says, I'm sorry, Mama. I gave it to Pietro so he can scare his parents. I was even worse received than the first Vovichka joke. That's it. I'm done with Vovichka. Even by the standards of these jokes, those are bombing. Okay. So dynamics, in other words, so far everything we've been talking about is, you know, how matter behaves in how particles behave in Friedman-Robertson-Walker spacetimes, what the horizons look like, who can send signals to whom. Dynamics is about, if you put some matter in the spacetime, how does the matter drive the expansion of the spacetime, and then how does it respond to the expansion of the spacetime? How does it dilute? So again, the Einstein equations, we said, reduced to two key equations, the so-called Friedman equation. And the so-called continuity equation. Where rho is the physical energy density. Okay, so at any given moment, if you take a little box, take a small box around the point x, around the spatial point x, you add up all of the energy in that box and divide it by the physical volume of the box. So in other words, take the co-moving volume of the box, multiply it by a cubed to get the physical volume, because the length of each side of the box, its co-moving length times A is the physical length. So the energy divided by the physical volume, that's what the energy density rho here means. P is the pressure of pressure pushing out on the walls of that box. And H is the Hubble expansion rate, which is A dot over A, in other words, dA dt divided by A. So it's how fast the scale factor is expanding at any given moment in time. You'll sometimes hear this thing loosely referred to as the Hubble constant, but just remember it's not a constant in time. It changes with time depending on what the function A of t looks like. It is a constant in space in a homogeneous universe. So okay, so for simplicity, let's think about, oh, So let's first do the following thing. Let's divide both. Nope. So henceforth, so when Einstein introduced the cosmological constant, he thought about it as a constant that is a geometrical term, and another term on the left-hand side of Einstein's equations. Okay. But the modern view is that, well, this term is also exactly what you would get if you just took the, let's say, the if you had a scalar field. In the simplest case, the matter in your universe is a scalar field with some potential v of phi. And if you just added to the potential a constant, so you sent v of phi to v of phi plus a constant, or I guess the particular constant that you want to add is lambda over 8 pi g Newton, you would get exactly the same, you would get exactly a term like this. So in other words, from now on, for simplicity, we are going to reinterpret this thing as, rather than some sort of geometrical property of the space-time, we're going to just interpret this as another contribution to the energy density over here. So the so-called vacuum energy. In other words, the extra energy that you would get, for example, not by exciting whatever fields live in your space-time, but just by adding an overall constant to the potential energy function that appears in their action. Okay, so from now on, I'm just going to forget about this term, which I don't mean set it to zero, but absorb it into the meaning of the stress energy tensor. And so I'll do the same thing here. Okay, so if we take our Friedman equation and divide by h squared, it becomes sometimes useful to write it that way. Okay. So at any given moment in time, in an expanding universe, I take the Hubble expansion rate at that time, h of t, square it, and 3h squared divided by 8 pi times Newton's constant has units of density, and that's a special value of the density called the critical density. Okay, and the reason that is called the critical density, you can see if you write the equation in this form. Okay, so in other words, I've divided by h squared on both sides here, so this becomes 8 pi g over 3h squared. In other words, 1 over the critical density. So rho over rho critical minus k over a squared h squared. So what you can see here is that according to the Friedman equation, there is a connection between the value of k and the value of rho. Namely, that for that equation to be true, if k is equal to 0, then this equation says that rho has to be equal to the critical density at every moment in time. And if k is greater than, if k is plus 1, in other words, if the universe is positively curved like a sphere, then in order for this equation to be satisfied, so this term makes a negative contribution, so rho had better be greater than rho crit in order for that equation to be satisfied. And if k is less than 1, if k is equal to minus 1, I mean, then rho is less than rho crit. Okay, and k is a constant. K doesn't change with time. So this equation says that if k is plus 1, then rho is always greater than rho crit. Rho crit changes with time, but rho at any point in the evolution of the universe is always greater than the critical density at every time in that same universe. And if k is equal to 0, then as a function of time, rho is always equal to the critical density. And if k is equal to minus 1, rho is always less than the critical density. Okay, so this is often used, the terminology often used here is a k equals 0 universe where rho is equal to rho crit is called flat. when rho is greater than rho crit, it's called closed. And when rho is less than rho crit, it's called open, an open universe. And here it's important to say this, don't be confused by this terminology, flat. This means that the spatial sections are flat, but the space-time itself is of course not flat. For example, we saw all the Christoffel symbols in a flat FRW universe are not, you know, they're non-zero Christoffel symbols, and that's a coordinate dependent thing, but a coordinate independent thing is the Ricci scalar, which for example is 6h squared in a, so the space-time is, in none of these situations is the space-time flat, but the spatial sections, the maximally symmetric spatial sections, are flat when k is equal to zero. Okay. Yeah.
What would you allow that k can change from plus one to minus one?
That is not what the FRW solutions are. In other words, the whole idea of the FRW solutions is that they are spatially homogeneous solutions that just expand and contract as a function of time. And what we showed is that in such a solution, you could always rescale the coordinates so that k was equal to, so that if k was positive, it was strictly equal to minus one and didn't change with time, or strictly equal to plus one and didn't change with time. That was one thing I showed in the last lecture. So, well, so that would be discontinuous for one thing. I mean, they have different topologies. So you couldn't do that without. I mean, if you just put in by hand, so if you just put in by hand that up to one moment, that the spatial sections were k equals plus one, and at the next moment, the spatial sections were subsequent to that moment, the spatial sections were k equals minus one, now that would correspond to a discontinuous change in the manifold. The spatial manifold would suddenly at that moment go from being a finite sphere to an infinite plane. So there's no continuous way to match them. Unless, I mean, the one thing you could do is if you took a spatially closed universe and waited until the scale factor diverged, or arranged to have the scale factor diverge to infinity at some finite time, and then, you know, that normally you think of the universe that's a so-called big rip if a goes to infinity at a finite time. So in fact you will have a curvature singular. It's a bit like, so you could in principle think about taking a spatial three sphere, letting it expand to infinite size, letting a go to infinity, so that the actual physical size of the three sphere was going to infinity. And then at the next moment, you know, try to match that onto a negative k equals one section that again was expanded in such a way you might be able to do that, but there would be a curvature singularity at the it would be a bit like matching together a universe that contracts to a Big Bang to one that expands from a Big Bang. There's a curvature singularity at the matching. I don't think you can get away with it without having a curvature singularity. Is the short story.
Do,
so So I guess what I'm saying is that if you, well, it's a good exercise. Try to prove me wrong. But here's the reason I don't think that it'll turn out to be wrong. So if at some moment the sphere has only gotten to a finite size, and then suddenly at that moment, the space suddenly jumps from a finite size manifold to a manifold with infinite size, infinite spatial size. Well, you know, that sounds like trouble. That sounds like some very discontinuous thing. It couldn't possibly be a solution of Einstein's equations. On the other hand, if you want to avoid that problem, you would have to first make this thing diverge to infinite size, the sphere diverge to infinite size before you did the matching. But you will find that when you try to make the scale factor diverge to infinite size at a finite time, that corresponds to causing trouble. There are these papers about so-called big rip singularities, which are exactly spacetimes that behave like that. They're kind of the dual of Big Bang singularities, where A goes to zero at a finite time, or these big rip singularities, where A goes to infinity at a finite time. But they're equally problematic. I was going to say, let's put it this way. If you can make it work, you will have found something cool. So it couldn't hurt to try. So I was just going to say briefly that if we take the continuity equation, rho dot is equal to minus 3 h rho plus p, so it's often the case that at least locally in time, that the relationship between p and rho is that they are proportional to one another with a proportionality constant, which is conventionally called w. In any case, this is a convenient ansatz that, in other words, p of t is equal to a constant w times rho of t. That's a convenient. This is not the most general thing that you can have. For example, our universe is described like this sometimes, but then not at other points in its evolution. But for understanding the dynamics of the FRW universe, it's interesting to see what solutions you get under this hypothesis. So if I plug this in here, if I use this to remove p, this becomes rho dot is equal to minus 3h 1 plus w rho. And then let me divide on both sides by d rho and multiply on both sides by dt. So this becomes d rho over rho is equal to minus 3 1 plus w dA over A. And so if I integrate on this side, I get log rho. If I integrate on this side, I get log A. And I exponentiate both sides. This just says that rho in such a universe is proportional to A to the minus 3 1 plus w. Okay, so in other words, the continuity equation is saying that if the constant W is bigger, in other words, if the pressure is a bigger fraction of the energy density, a more positive fraction of the energy density, then in such a universe, the energy density dilutes more quickly as a function of with the scale factor. And so let's just think about. Think about three special cases here. So when w is equal to minus 1, then 1 plus w is 0, and the energy density doesn't dilute at all. It just sits there. The volume of the space expands, but locally the energy density just sits there. It's a constant. That is the equation of state of so-called vacuum energy. So in particular, if you put in a cosmological constant, lambda, and reinterpreted it, as part of T mu nu, if that was the dominant contribution to T mu nu, you would find that it behaved exactly in this way. So rho is proportional to a to the zero. In other words, it doesn't dilute. It doesn't dilute with the expansion of the universe. Another important case is W is equal to zero. So This is non-relativistic matter, also sometimes called dust, also sometimes just called matter. So this is where the pressure is negligible relative to the energy density. So that's what non-relativistic matter is like. So non-relativistic matter, a massive particle has energy mc squared. Its rest mass m times c squared times its gamma factor, its relativistic gamma factor. And then non-relativistically, this becomes gamma becomes nearly one. It becomes one plus a correction, which is the non-relativistic kinetic energy. So when this is negligible, the pressure of this matter is negligible relative to its energy density. Its energy density is just, well, if I have a little box here, I take a co-moving box and I fill it with particles. Each particle has energy mc squared. So the number density of particles times the energy of each particle, the number density of particles, little n, times mc squared, that's the energy density, approximately in this case. And then as the universe expands, again, if this box is co-moving with the expansion, then we don't have any net flow of particles into or out of the box. The number of particles in the box, at least on average, remains constant. There may be a little bit of drifting in and out, but so the co-moving number density remains constant. The number of particles remains constant. The co-moving volume of the box remains constant. But the physical number density goes down as 1 over a cubed because, again, the number of particles in the box stays constant, but the physical volume grows as a cubed. But then the energy per particle is just mc squared. It stays constant. So the energy density in that case goes down as a to the minus 3, which is, in other words, that's what you get when you plug in W equals 0 here. This goes as a to the minus 3. And then the final important case is W equals 1/3. So in other words, the pressure is equal to 1/3 of the energy density. That turns out to be the equation of state of highly relativistic matter. In other words, a gas of particles whose rest masses are negligible. They're moving very relativistically. Their gamma factor here, where did their gamma factor go? So their energy density was mc squared gamma. And we said in a case where gamma, where v is much less than c, so gamma reduces to 1 plus a small correction, that's the non-relativistic case. In the case where gamma is much, much greater than 1, in other words, v is very close to c, then the equation of state is like this. And the way you can see that is, well, if we plug in W equals 1/3 here, this becomes 4/3 times minus 3. So the energy density goes down as a to the minus 4. And intuitively, what's going on is that now we again consider our co-moving box. But now the universe is full of a gas of photons, which are streaming every which way. So there's no net flow of photons. You know, photons are constantly streaming in and out of the walls of this particular co-moving box that we've drawn, but the number streaming out and the number streaming in are the same on average. So the number of photons in the box is constant, and the co-moving size of the co-moving volume of the box is constant, but the physical volume again is growing as a cubed. So the physical number density is going down as 1 over a cubed, but then the energy density is going down as 1 over a to the fourth because, in addition, each photon, we said that when a photon streams through a Friedman-Robertson-Walker universe, remember, its momentum goes down as 1 upon a, but a photon's momentum, the magnitude of its momentum, is just its energy. In other words, we said its frequency, momentum, magnitude of its spatial momentum is equal to its energy, because of this relation. So the physical number density goes down as 1 upon a cubed. The energy per particle goes down as 1 upon a, and so the energy density, the physical energy density for a gas of photons or for a gas of highly relativistic particles goes down as 1 upon a to the fourth. Okay, so these are three important cases to keep in mind. Most of the early universe, the early universe that we know and love that produced the cosmic microwave background and the and Big Bang nucleosynthesis, which we'll talk about later in the week, was very well approximated for a long time by W equals minus a third. And then there was a subsequent epoch after when galaxies were forming and the solar system was forming that was very well approximated by W equals zero. And then recently in cosmic history, there's evidence that the universe is becoming dominated by something that appears to be acting as if it had W equals minus one. So this is the so-called cosmological constant that there appears to be evidence for today. And then according to inflation, there was also an epoch in the very early universe where W was almost equal to minus one. Anyway, so maybe I should stop there. I'll pick up next time there's just a few more things to say to close out the dynamics discussion about how the evolution of the scale factor A of t responds to a given type of matter content in the universe. But then, as I say, the main point of the next lecture will be to explain how to do thermodynamics, statistical mechanics, and basic particle physics in an expanding universe. Okay?